Please be aware the stories, theories, reenactments, and language in this podcast are of an adult nature and can be disturbing, frightening, and even in some cases, offensive. Listener discretion is therefore advised. Hey, there is very adult content ahead, and you have been warned. Welcome, Helans. Welcome to the world of the weird and unexplained. I am your host, Nicole Delacroix, and together we will be exploring stories about the weird, wonderful, unexplained, eerie, scary, and downright unbelievable. There will be tales of ghosts, murder, supernatural beings, and unexplained mysteries. So sit back, grab your favorite drink, relax, and prepare to be transported to today's dark enigma. And on today's Dark Enigma, we're going to be exploring the dark and seductive world of vampires. Please note, there are no sparkly teenage angsty vampires here. No. We're looking at where the legends started from and how vampires are ingrained in our collective memories. As always, we will be playing our drinking game, but only for those of you that are at home and have nowhere else to fly off to tonight. There's a bat joke in there, right? So we could easily go for the obvious, yeah, Bloody Mary shots, but live a little, guys. There are some really great drinks out there. This time, I'm not doing the work for you. So look up one of my very favorite drinks, a vampire cocktail. Okay, I lied just a little bit. There's a link. But they're super delicious and extra creepy. So every time I say sparkly is a single shot. And every time I say Christianity, well, that's gonna be a double shot, because I need to be pretty drunk for that. All right, now that we have our business end out of the way, we can jump headfirst into today's dark enigma. In every culture around the world, we find signs and folklore pertaining to vampirism. As you know, there's nothing like a good vampire story, or even a bad one, apparently. So, I'm going to jump into the very first, and in my opinion, the very best legend of vampires. That's right, we're talking the story of Lilith. Now, Lilith is a tale that comes from rabbinical fable called a Midrash. Lilith was actually the first wife of Adam, and she was cast out of Eden because she refused to assume a subordinate sexual position. That's right, guys, we don't like missionary position. Get over it. We want to be on top. Anyways, Lilith was transformed into a nocturnal monster that mated with animals and sought out the children of Adam and Eve, killing them vengefully and consuming their flesh. Now, there are very, very different versions of this fable, which we might actually look into later, but we're going to be examining the very different species of vampires in all the other cultures besides our own. And thus begins our look at vampires in many different cultures. What, did you really think that the English-speaking world had a monopoly on that one? Nope, we only have a monopoly on the ridiculous, sparkly ones. Haha, that's a drink. At one time, it was believed that vampires were ranked highest among the demons as chief agents of sin by the different cultures of the world, and almost every single country out there has some sort of vampire legend. The stories can be traced back to the time before the pyramids were even built in Egypt, and Egypt and India are considered the birthplace of the vampire. But it has been suggested that the home of the vampire is really in Tibet, but the Greek island of Santorini is traditionally the most vampire-infested place in the world. Yeah, I'm not sure how that happened, but okay. Different cultures attributed many different characteristics to vampires, which are quite interesting and should be noted. For example, the Greek and regions of the Balkans, for example, believed that blue-eyed people were most likely to become vampires. Why, you ask? Well, this belief was due to the fact that there was a serious lack of blue-eyed people in that region. Duh. They were different, and therefore, there must be something wrong with them. Well, I know most of the people I know with blue eyes have something wrong with them. On the other end of the spectrum, the Irish believed that blue or gray-eyed people had the ability to see ghosts, and, well, since vampires are considered the Walking Dead, they would be able to see them for what they really were. Now, the Greek also believed that red hair combined with blue eyes was a vampiric attribute. But interestingly, there was never mention of fangs as an attribute of the vampire in European folklore. This attribute actually came around from literature, specifically Varney the Vampire in 1840. Go look it up. It's a pretty damn good book. But considering the original association with evil, disease, and death, it's really kind of amazing that this creature has become the most sensually appealing part of American culture. Unless they happen to be sparkly. Huh, there's another one. When you stop and think that the original image we had before literature and Hollywood began transforming it was that of a horrible beast that originated in Slavic traditions. That's right, the early vampire of Eastern Europe in the Baltic region were often considered either a very old or a very young woman. There were only rare examples of male vampires. And when the odd male vampire did turn up, well, their characteristics were usually quite different than what we think they are. The version of the male vampire is not one of a noble one, as Hollywood have you believe. In fact, they tended to be of the opposite social status. That's right, hermits and the homeless were often targeted as vampires and put on trial for the murderous ways in medieval Europe. Oh, to be back in medieval Europe, yes, you know, where you could die at any turn. When we look at the origination myths, you will quickly understand why some people believe that the vampire originated in the Far East, such places as China, Tibet, and India. With the track caravans moving along the silk routes to the Mediterranean, and then spreading the stories out along the Black Sea coast to Greece, the Balkans, and of course the Carpathian Mountains, including Hungary and Transylvania. The most interesting facet of the vampire tale is to look at its relation to religion, specifically Christianity. Uh-oh, double shot. With Christianity, quadruple shot, maybe? No, okay. With Christianity making its steps to take over the world, the role of the vampire changed considerably. One god and one strength, and thus evil became weakened. Vampires of seduction, possession, and death were considered the minions of the devil, along with alchemists, witches, sorcerers, atheists, and, you know, pretty much everybody else. When the Catholic Church officially broke in 1054 AD, the Bulgarians, Russians, and Serbians decided to stay Orthodox, while the Poles, Czechs, and Croatians went Roman Catholic. This split caused a big difference in the development of vampire lore. The Roman Church believed that incorrupt bodies were saints, while the Orthodox Church believed these same incorrupt bodies were those of vampires. Roman Christianity eventually won out, and the vampires and other pagan beliefs only survive in folklore now. The link between the church and vampirism is the act of communion. Yep, bear with me, guys. You're gonna see it, and you're gonna be like, holy crap, how did I miss that? Millions of Catholics participate in this act every time they attend Mass. By drinking the wine and eating the host, they are literally eating and drinking the body and blood of Christ. The theory here is that the drinking of blood, the wine, of Christ, you will have eternal life with God. Hello, vampires. This is similar to the vampire, but only in modern traditions. Keep in mind that the earlier vampire traditions of Europe did not always depict the creature as one who rose from the dead. It was more like a beast or a cannibal. Our modern-day vampire folklore, however, shows the risen-from-the-dead creature drinks blood and is given eternal life, as blood is the life essence of all creatures. Now, there's something that's going to keep you up thinking tonight, isn't it? The church gave us our basic preventative measures as well. You could keep a vampire in his grave by nailing his clothes to the coffin walls. This will also prevent him from eating his own shroud. Another form of prevention was opening the graves and checking to see if the corpse has become one of the undead. 'Cause duh, right? A child's grave would be opened after 3 years, a young person would be given 5 years before the opening, and an adult would be checked after 7 years. I'm not sure where they came up with this year chart, but whatever. Also, one could try placing a headstone over the grave. That's right. It seems that headstones were not originally used as remembrance of loved ones, but it was rather a weight to prevent a vampire from escaping. Aren't your minds just blown, right? You can also try burying food with the vampire, as a well-fed vampire does not feel the need to cannibalize or leave his own grave. I've always said it, a happy cop is a busy cop. Oh, wait, that's not the right one. Sorry. The last way is taking the left sock from the corpse and filling it with stones and then throwing it into the river. Yeah, I'm not sure what that one was supposed to do, but hey, now you know what happens to all those missing socks from laundry day, right? Now, we're going to start looking at many varieties of vampires. What, did you really didn't think that they were originally and Sparkly were the only versions, did you? I mean, come on, seriously. There's more than just the original and Sparkly ones. From the erotic tales of the Lamia in Roman and Greek literature to the decrepit depictions of the Rakshas by the Hindu Vedas, one can see a certain evolution of the role of the vampire that parallels humanity's concept of the forbidden and evil. People of polytheistic religions, with many gods and goddesses, who are all assigned certain responsibilities, would most likely be able to recognize the various degrees of good and bad and the importance of all in life. Those of a monotheistic belief would most certainly have set definitions of what is good and what is evil in that oh-so-famous black-and-white outlook we have. Also, a critically important characteristic to watch for is the selective feeding practices of the vampire. Hey, they are partial to children and members of the opposite sex. Alright, so without much further ado-do, here we go. That's right, I said ado-do, get over it. Alright, The Walking Dead, The Draugr, and The Aptranger in Old Norse literature. Yes, that's right, from the people who brought us Beowulf and Thor comes even more fun creatures with difficult-to-pronounce names. Ah, the Vikings' concept of the afterlife, where a once-dead body placed in the grave is believed to become animated with a strange life and power. So, basically, yeah. The dead person just continues a pseudo-life within the grave. I'm not sure if they were just playing with the worms or if there was an actual point to that, but, you know, there you have it. So, next time somebody dies, throw a deck of cards in there so they can at least have some fun. Anyway, these creatures are not depicted as a spirit or a ghost, more like a description of Nosferatu. Hey, if you don't know what that is, you need to go and look it up because, hello, first movie with a vampire in it. Check it out. The undead were known by many different names in Norse literature, and we're going to talk about a few, but there's lots of them, and seriously, this show is only so long. Alright, so we're going to start with the Haubui. That's Haubui. If you know how to pronounce it, more power to you. And it's Norwegian. It's also known as a mound dweller. Basically, this is a dead body living on in its tomb, and they are rarely found far from the burial place. And they will only harm those who dare to trespass on its grave. Honestly, not sure what the hell that one's for. Cause, okay. The Draugr, which is Icelandic. Now this is an animated corpse that comes forth from its grave mound or shows restlessness on the way to the burial place. This creature is also known as an Aptranger, or an aftergoer, or one who walks after death. The Draugr is the roaming undead, most frequently encountered in Icelandic sagas. Whichever name they use, the undead of Scandinavia was a physical body, the actual corpse of the deceased. The physical descriptions of the undead in Scandinavian cultures are also said to be Helblar, or black as death. Another term to use to describe the undead is Nafole, meaning corpse pale. So either you were really black or you were really pale. I'm not sure where that's going with Scandinavia, but okay. The other characteristics of the Draugr are that they can swell to an enormous size and are also very heavy, which suggests that the swelling may not be just due to decaying gases. And I'm sorry to say it, but I do feel that a GasX advert right here is pretty damn appropriate. But you guys get the gist. Described as being uncorrupt, and for many years after death, the creature has extreme strength. They tend to kill by crushing their victims to death. Okay, I guess that's where the bloated size and the weight comes in. Yay! I want to die by being sat on. But what I want to know is, do they sit on you and then it's the dreaded fart of death that my sister used to do when we were younger? Alright, anyway. The drugger also possess magical powers, because, you know, the magical fart, I guess. They have knowledge of the future, so they know when they're going to fart. They can control the weather, and they have shape-shifting capabilities. Ah, so they can become the fart. Okay, enough with the farts. The drugger could also move magically through the earth as though they were swimming through the stone. Cool. Luckily for the Vikings, there were precautions that they could take against the drugger. These precautions were practiced from Viking times to present to prevent the dead from rising again in Scandinavia. Some of the easier way to prevent the dead from rising was to place an open pair of scissors on the dead person's chest, laying straws crosswise under the shroud. They would also tie the big toes together so that the legs could not be separated, and needles would be run into the soles of the feet. I'm just going to say, seriously, for the zombie apocalypse, I'm liking the tying the feet together, because then all the zombies are going to be tripping and falling, because that's probably a smart thing we should start doing. Anyways, the precautions were always done directly to the corpse. The following, however, were precautions taken on the things surrounding the corpse to prevent it from rising. When the coffin is carried out, the bearers would stop at the door just within the threshold, and they would raise and lower the coffin 3 times in different directions, thus forming the sign of the cross. Once this had been done, all the chairs and stools on which the casket had rested must be turned over. Now, during the actual burial in the churchyard, the parson must pray for the rest of the dead and binds the grave itself with magical words, thus making it impossible for the dead to escape. Wait, is this the Catholic version of Harry Potter? Maybe not. All right. The Scandinavians also had special corpse doors in the home. These were bricked-up openings that could be torn down to remove the coffin feet first. Then the doorway would be resealed again firmly. This was done immediately because it was believed the dead could only enter a home from the way that they were removed. By removing the corpse feet first, it was thought that they were depriving the undead of a clear view of how they were removed from the home. Doesn't the coffin being closed kind of take care of that? Okay, well, never mind. Now, considering the time period during which the legends of Scandinavia were created, it's really no surprise. They were unaware of the effect of germs, the effect that the germs from the corpses had on them. So, of course, they believed that the dead were just trying to spread evil. As the drugger was dead, it was felt that they had a longing for the things of life and even envied those still alive. They felt cold, hungry, and longed for their loved ones. So to express their feelings and needs, well, they killed things. Because I know when I'm hungry and lonely, that's what I do, right? They would decimate livestock of those they cared for that they cared for by running them to death. Okay, so I'm dead and I'm lonely and I miss you, so I'm going to kill everything around you. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. To kill the drugger, one must overcome them by hand-to-hand combat, wrestling it until it has been subdued. Then, the combatant must decapitate the ghost with a sword. Some traditions have the hero leap or walk between the head and body 3 times, or the hero could drive a wooden stake into the headless body. The final step was to burn the remains until they became cold ashes, and then either bury the ashes in a remote spot or throw them out to sea. That is a little bit overkill for me, but whatever. Interesting, though, note that the Draugr and the Grendel from Beowulf display a lot of the same characteristics. Grendel was a giant shape-shifting creature, a dweller of the supernatural environment. Grendel spends most of its time acting out motives of envy and desire for the things in life. Incorporated are elements from the old Germanic culture of Anglo-Saxons and some newer influences of Christianity, and voila, we have Grendel from Beowulf. Well, now we're going to move on to the Greeks. Ah, yes, the crystal blue of the Mediterranean and the Vrykolakis, which is Greek for vampire. And I asked somebody who's Greek how to pronounce that. So if it's wrong, bite me. And, of course, the Vrykolakos is the body of an evil and wicked man, often one who has been excommunicated. These bodies do not, like other corpses, decompose after burial, but have a very tough skin, become swollen and distended. And this is a direct quote by Leo Alatius on current opinions of certain Greeks from 1645. That's right, I did some research. The Vrykolakos were an incredibly ravenous creature. This is especially true as there were two different species of the Vrykolakos. One was dead and returned from the grave, and the other, well, he was alive, but in a dreamlike state, as though they were sleepwalking. So how'd you tell them apart? That's my question. The latter was usually spotted roaming at night when the moon was full. Seized by thirst and blood, they go out at night, scour the country, biting and tearing both man and beast. The Vrykolakos also have roots in Macedonia, which is not only associated with Greece, but also the Balkan area. These creatures are active from 10 p.m. until the first cockcrow in the morning. Yeah, I really had fun with that one. Cockcrow! They have been vampires from natural causes. In this case, from having a desire to have wine over its face. Wait, what? Wine over its face? Wait, I have a desire to have wine in my face. Oh, wait, on its face. Okay, that's different. Never mind. The cure for this species is pouring boiling oil over it, or by sticking a long nail into its navel. It would also be worthwhile to spread birdseed over the tomb, because it will have to count the seeds before leaving. Okay, not only is he a vampire, but he's an OCD vampire? Seriously? Can't we have him, like, cleaning bird poop or something? Wouldn't that be a little bit more helpful? Okay, moving on. Anyways, in the Adriatic and Aegean regions, the Vrykolakos travel at night and knocks upon doors, calling out the names of people inside. And if the person responds, well, they're going to die soon afterwards. And, of course, this particular species gains power as it ages. But if it's dead, how does it age, is my question. Okay, on that note, my darlings, we're going to take a little break here, play a little music, and maybe hear an ad from one of our sponsors. So join us after the break. And welcome back, my heathens, or my vampires, whichever one you are. So glad that I didn't scare you off by the weird and basically useless versions of vampires from the Nordic and Greek variety. But hey, I have some more, and I promise you we're going to find one that gets your blood pumping. Yeah, blood jokes. There's going to be lots of those. So let's jump right back into it. All right. The Kathakano is a vampire from Crete. Now, they are very similar to the most common garden variety of vampires, with one exception. They can only be killed by chopping off the head and boiling it in vinegar. Yeah. Okay. The Kathakano is from Crete and Rhodes area, and they are described as having a mouth that is always grinning, showing very white teeth. It spits blood onto its victim's skin, producing horrible burns. The cure for this form of vampirism is burning its nails in flames, boiling its head in vinegar, or isolating it behind a barrier of water, preferably salted water. So, acidic spitting blood, check. Weirdly, oddly white grin, check, check. Somebody get the vinegar, seriously. Alright, moving on to the Lamia. Now, the Lamia are part of Greek and Roman mythology and folklore. These are exclusively female vampires, which often appear as half-human, half-animal, most often a snake, and always the snake is the lower part of the body, because snakes. They ate the flesh of their victims as well as drinking their blood. Lamias could be attacked and killed with normal weapons, because, you know, there's nothing really weird about them. The story of how the Lamia was created goes something a little bit like this. At one time, she was the queen of Libya, and she fell in love with Zeus, the leader of the gods, because, you know, who doesn't fall in love with the big jock? Together, the god and the mortal woman had many children. Zeus's wife, however, Hera, found out about the affair between her husband and the queen, and about all the children fathered by her husband. She decided she was going to teach the queen a lesson by killing her children and then killing the queen. Because, well, the man's never at fault. At least not in Greek mythology. Because of her punishment, Lamia decides to take her revenge. She decides that all should be punished because, legit, it's everybody else's fault. Women should suffer as she did by losing their children, on which she feeds. Also, she is reputed to entice men into sexual intercourse and then devours them in a gruesome fashion. And I'm just going to say, seriously, what guy doesn't like, you know, a half snake, half female, right? Because, wow, right? Anyways, through these sexual encounters, she bore many supernatural children, collectively known as the Lamiae. Not like gold sparkly Lamiae, but Lamiae. The children were sorceresses with the head and breast of a beautiful woman and the bodies of snakes. Because Greeks. They used their siren-like voices to lure men and children to them, and then they devoured them by sucking their blood. Because that's what vampires do. They suck. Hence the title of this episode. Now, the Brucolaco. Oh, and I love saying that. Brucolaco. Sounds like it should be like a Greek taco or something. Well, it's a Greek vampire. It is described as having swollen, tense, and hard skin as though it has been tanned. So every Greek guy I've ever known. When hit, this vampire sounds like a drum. And for some unknown reason, they have nicknamed it Timpanita. And he has a sonorous voice, but he can only emit one scream per night. He causes death to anyone who responds to his nightly call, thereby spreading the plague. He is believed to have become a vampire by being excommunicated from the church. And the preventative curse is, well, you know, don't excommunicate him. Okay. A minor method of defense when hearing the vampire's call at nights, well, don't answer until you hear the second call, because he can only do it once. Just hope you're not next to, like, a cliff where it echoes, right? When the evil becomes apparent from the grave, one must cut off the head of the vampire and burn it. At Milos, it is advised to cut the head of the vampire off, cut it into pieces, and boil it in wine, because Greeks. The Brucolaco are primarily from the Greek regions of Thessaly and Epirus, and there are people who fall into catalepsis, or a loss of sensation or muscle rigidity. So, maybe rigor mortis, possibly. The soul thus being momentarily separated from the body and going into that of a wolf, making it thirsty for flesh and blood. Once again, because Greeks. And don't get me wrong, I love my Greek people, because seriously, like, one of my best friends is Greek and I love her to death. Best food ever. The Impusa is another Greek vampire, one who possesses a demonic spirit that could enter the body. They are usually said to be in the attendance of the goddess Hecate. Described as demons, which can take human form from time to time, their most common incarnation is that of a Phoenician woman. I don't know why she's Phoenician, but she's Phoenician. Get over it. The Mormo was also another Greek vampire, because the Greeks love their vampires, and they have to have each and every one of them different. It was considered a terrible denizen of Hades that attended to the witch goddess Hecate again. Apparently, they were quite nasty little buggers. However, there's not a whole lot of information about them other than that. That's it. Alright, from the Grecian islands, we now move on to Russian vampire lore, because, seriously, you gotta love it. Our first look at Russia gives us the Ipur and the Ipor. Yeah, they're spelled differently, but they're pronounced exactly the same. And they were a very integral part of Russian folklore. This vampire was able to walk the earth in broad daylight, and according to legend, the Ipur rose at noon and fed from the populace until midnight, when it was forced to return to its grave to rest. The Ipur was also popular in the Ukrainian region of Russia, and that version, well, was noted to eat large amounts of fish. So, basically, Russian people. Don't get this. Another legend related to the Ipur, the other spelling, in Russia, shows us a vampire that was considered extremely vicious. It will first attack children, and then continue on to kill the parents. It rose during the day and slept at night, and in doing so had a pretty fairly human appearance. So I'm just going to say it, Russian versions are really just really shitty humans, is all I can say. Okay. Then we have the Ipirissi of Russia, which becomes a vampire by suicide, violent death, or practicing witchcraft during one's lifetime, because you gotta throw an oddball in there. They could cause drought, even dry the dew on most plants. And the cure for this type of vampirism was to drown the vampire in a lake or river. But if they could cause a drought, wouldn't the lake or river be gone? Okay, never mind. You could also destroy this vampire by transfixing it with a nail. However, you must not hit the nail more than once, or the Ipirissi will revive itself. And there's a new version of the one and done that I've never heard before, but now we've all heard it. Okay. We also have another vampire with a similar spelling, the Ipirissi, was seen in both Russian and Polish folklore. These vampires were also known as the Visisi. They had stingers under their tongues, woohoo, which was used instead of fangs. They were active from noon until midnight. What is this, these specific time frames? Never mind. Okay. So they were active from noon until midnight and could only be destroyed by burning. When burned, the body would burst, giving rise to hundreds of small, disgusting animals, like maggots and rats and mice and all that good stuff. If any of these creatures were to escape, then the Ipirissi spirit would escape too, and would seek revenge. And I'm just saying, if you caught all of that, more power to you. And this one I'm gonna totally butcher the name on, so send me an email, don't send me an email, I don't give a shit. The Mitrajovic was a favorite of European Russians. It had a purple face and was active from midnight until the cock crows thrice in the morning. Why does it have to crow three times? Seriously, what's up? They became a vampire from natural causes. If the deceased was the son of a werewolf or a witch, or else if in its lifetime it had behaved as a werewolf, a sorcerer, an apostate, or if it had cursed its own father or the church. That pretty much means everybody. The cure for this type of vampire is only preventative. One could sprinkle poppy seeds along the road leading from the tomb to the house of the deceased. When the evil becomes apparent, the people closest to the vampire must either transfix the creature through the chest, nailing it to the coffin, or burn it. Other than that, you're screwed. Alright, the Vordulak is also another Russian vampire. And in Russian folklore, it's to be a beautiful but very evil woman. Uh-oh. I might be talking about myself. Hang on. I haven't been able to find any more on that one, or quite possibly I may be one and don't want to tell you how to defeat me. Well, I'm not really Russian and not really a vampire. Oh well, there was no information on it, so we'll skip it. The Eretica was a formidable Russian vampire species. It was an evil Russian spirit who was a heretic returned from the dead, a woman who sold her soul in life, or a mixture of both. 'Cause Russians. Gotta love them. They take the form of a haggard old woman and gather in ravines to perform a sort of Sabbath. They are only active during spring and autumn, and the result of seeing the eyes of one would result in a slow and painful death. Much like this episode. Alright, from Russia, we are now going to move on to Romania. These people had some really interesting vampire folklore. I think the best place we can start is going to be the Moroi. These vampires are considered one of the undead, but they were viewed more as guardians of their mortal families. Obviously, one of the more friendly vampires are spirits. They can be male or female. They do, however, exhibit some of the same characteristics of the Strigoi, who we're going to be discussing in a moment. Another trait mentioned about the Moroi is that they went out at night to fornicate with, you know, basically whoever they came across. I can most definitely be one of them. Basically, they come out at night, they party, and they fuck. I like them. Alright, kudos to you, Romania. You've brought this back around. Alright, the Strigoi of Romania is also one of the undead. They attract utter revulsion and fear of the populace. They were a blood-drinking species and hunted by most of those living in the Balkans. Another source claims that the Strigoi are living, as opposed to the undead. The soul has the ability to voluntarily leave the body at night. Sometimes such souls appear as sparks traveling through the air. They could take the form of insects or higher animals. They are not usually associated with blood sucking. They could steal the vitality of their neighbor's crops, the beehives, and so on and so forth. The Roman word Strigoi is derived from the Latin word strix. Romanians believed in witches that would change into screech owls at night to prey on unattended infants by drinking their blood and sometimes eating their internal organs. I'm not sure where that last part came in, but hey, you know, it's stuff you need to know. All right. The Norfrodat of Romania became a vampire by being the illegitimate son of two illegitimate parents, or by being the seventh son of a seventh son. So, basically, a lot of fucking going on here. They would appear as an attractive person of the opposite sex who would repeatedly visit the homes of their victims, because fucking. The victims would then slowly lose vitality and die of illness and exhaustion, because, once again, fucking. And apparently this did take some time. Duh. Some stories even depict them as those who have been separated or torn apart from those that they love in life, and in death, seek to be reunited with their lost loved ones. Another added attraction of this vampire is their ability to make the husbands of their loved ones impotent. Okay. They are very specific on some of these, aren't they? I love it. The most recognizable name on our list of Romanian vampires is the Nosferatu. This was a spirit that again was the illegitimate child of illegitimate parents. It had a strong hatred for newly married couples due to its own illegitimacy and wreaks havoc on such couples as making the groom impotent, the bride barren, or a mixture of both because, you know, let's mess with the genitals. Soon after burial, the Nosferatu embarks on a long career of destruction because it's fun. It delights in tormenting and enjoys engaging in wild orgies with the living. And the males of this species can even father children. So basically, they're just guys. Just sorry to say it. I'm sorry. All right. The next part of our journey takes us to Albania. And here we find the Striga. This species was an elderly woman who preyed upon infants by drinking their blood. And just a note here, if any of you watch Supernatural, the Striga was actually in a Supernatural. And if you could tell me the name of the title, well, then you're just a geek. Okay. They also caused adults to wither and die. They could change into a moth, fly, or bee at night. Albanians blamed these creatures for crib death. Ironically, most Albanian infants who died in their cribs died from the being so overprotected from the Striga with swaddling blankets. So, yeah, you know. Most of those children, well, they grew pale and they got sick from the lack of sunshine. So, you know, let your kids go outside every now and again. Take away their phones. Just for fun. You know, no real reason. Just give me your damn phone. Okay. All right. We also have the Lulgat and Sampiro of Albania. And they go around at night wrapped in their burial shrouds and wearing high-heeled shoes. Because, you know, we wear thin veiled clothes and high-heeled shoes. So they're basically prostitutes. Okay. And its tomb is indicated by a will-o'-wisps. These creatures are created from being an Albanian of Turkish blood. This one seems a little bit racist. I'm just saying. It's not me. I'm just reporting it. Please don't send me emails on this. I love Albanians. I love Turkish people. Please don't send me emails. I love you both. Okay? I'm just saying. All right. Anyways, it spreads death and destruction wherever it goes. While investigating these beasts, I did find another source that stated that these creatures were said to be reasonably harmless, only feeding briefly on its victims, but not actually killing them. Again, proving that almost every source you use is pretty much going to have a different story. So, you know, none of this shit is going to be useful to you, so whatever. All right, let's journey to Africa and the Asnan Bossum of the Ashanti of southern Ghana. Yeah, okay, say that 10 times fast, why don't you? They are considered normal vampires. Like, what the fuck is normal anymore, right? With the exception that they have hooks instead of feet, and they tend to bite their victims on the thumb. Because Africa. They like to attack sleeping people in villages, and they aren't very particular, they'll attack men, women, children, they don't care. An interesting note to add here is that vampire bats rarely attack humans, but when they do, it is usually on the thumb, and the bats that attack are usually rabid. Okay, so that's just interesting. In other regions of Africa, such as Togo and the Ivory Coast, the Asan Balsam are believed to reside deep in the forest. Most often, they are encountered by hunters. They take generally human shapes, with two exceptions. Their teeth are made of iron, and their legs have hook-like appendages. So, anyone walking by the tree in which it resides is going to be scooped up and killed. So, basically, you know, iron teeth, hook legs, keep running. Okay. The Aba Yafo are found among the Asante people living in the Gold Coast of Africa. This is a living vampire, which can be either male or female. Doesn't matter. It is said to leave its body at night to feed. The Aba Yafo is particularly fond of young children as their main course and has been known to cause blights in crops. The Wumi of the Slave Coast became a vampire by being a criminal in life and or else being the victim of a curse because, you know, Africa. The only cure is to bury it in a secret place. So, that's fun. Then we have the Ads, which resides in southeast Ghana and southern Togo in Africa. This is the spirit of the ewe that flies around in the form of a firefly, but if caught, it will change into the form of a human. A ewe being a female sheep, I guess. It feeds on blood, palm oil, and coconut water, and it preys on young children, especially handsome ones. So, if you got cute kids, don't go to Africa. And, you know, if you do, who cares? The Impundalu is found on the eastern Cape region of Africa. It was usually passed down from mother to daughter and was used to inflict suffering on one's enemies. It was said to have an insatiable appetite and had to be continuously let to feed. It would also take the form of a handsome man and become a lover to its mistress. So, you know, twofold. Yeah, you gotta feed him, but that's okay. He's gonna fuck you later. Oh, is that where dinner in a movie came from? Never mind. Alright, so India, though, seems to be the one country that is most heavily populated by vampires. And we're going to start with the Batal. This vampire race was short in stature, only standing 1.5 meters tall. I'm just going to say, okay, even I could fight one off. But height was not the only thing that had set this particular species apart. It seems that the Batal is half man and half bat. Like most men I know. All right, then we have the Buta. Not the Buddha, the Buta. From Indian mythology, is a soul of a man who died an untimely death, usually violent in nature. So he's a Buddha brother. Basically, he's gotten his ass kicked. Okay, this is an ill-intentioned spirit that wanders around at night, animating dead bodies and attacking the living like a ghoul. They can also be found in cemeteries or other deserted places, feeding on excretion and intestines. Okay, that's gross. It eats poop. An attack by one of these creatures would usually result in severe sickness or death, because duh, he eats poop. The Buddha, also have a problem that they lack shadows and therefore cannot settle on the earth. Yeah, I'm not sure what that meant, but whatever. All right. The Rakshasa was a powerful Indian vampire and a magician. So, does he do, like, card tricks? Never mind. They like to confuse those around them by appearing either in human form with animal attributes, like claws and fangs and slitted eyes, etc., or as animals with human features. Feet, hands, flat nose, you get it. And the animal side is most often a tiger. They are known to eat the victim's flesh in addition to drinking the blood. The Rakshasa are a shape-shifting species of Hindu mythology that were originally created by the Brahma to protect the sea from those that wanted to steal the elixir of immortality from it. They lived in Lanka, or Ceylon, and were ruled by Rawana. Later, they became identified as demonic creatures that would often take the shape of a seductive woman and lure men to their deaths, because that's what we do. In other accounts, those creatures lived in trees and caused vomiting and indigestion to those who strayed too close to its domain. Yeah, because you get too close and I'm going to make you sick. That's what it was. It was said that children would become one of these creatures if they could be induced to eat human brains. Ew. Like, why would you want your kid to do that? Okay. The Rakshasa were no longer human, but still possessed a physical nature. They loved to prey upon the helpless. Another description of this vampire was a grave-wandering, flesh-eating, blood-drinking version of elves, sporting fangs and drenched in blood. Okay, rock on! As you can see, there are several different versions of this vampire, but they were all accepted as reality by the Hindus who wrote of such a creature in the Vedas. It was possible to destroy this creature by burning, exposing to sunlight, or exorcism. So now we know where we got the, he's adverse to sunlight, right? Another evil spirit of Hindu mythology and folklore was the, yeah, and I'm going to screw this one up, so just be prepared for it, the Brahma Purusha. This vampire-like creature was a head encircled by intestines and carried a skull from which it drank blood. It was told in folklore that this evil spirit enjoyed eating humans and it would drink the victim's blood through the skull it carried, then eat the victim's brains. Afterward, it would wrap the intestines of the victim around its body to perform a ritual dance. The hokey pokey, I'm guessing. You get the one. Never mind. I gotta stop myself right there because it's bad. The most famous vampire of India is Kali, of course, who had long flowing hair, wore a garland of corpses or skulls, and had four arms, because Indians, all right? Her temples were located near cremation grounds. She and the goddess Durga battled the king of demons Raktabija. Yeah, I know I screwed that one up. Don't send me an email. Who could reproduce himself from each drop of blood spilled. Oh, now that's a power I need. Okay. In order to defeat her opponent, Kali had to drink all of Raktabija's blood without spilling a drop. She did this, thereby winning the battle. Other names for Kali were Sarah, or the Black Goddess, by the gypsies. Her followers were called thugs and practiced thuggy, because I want to know what that is. These people were eventually held responsible of ritual murders in her name. All right. The Pakupati is another powerful vampire from India. And I only picked this one because how fun is Pakupati, right? Deemed as the lord of all beings of mischief. Oh, he must be my lord then. It is seen at night in cemeteries and places of execution. And the Pisacha, another name for the Pakupati, were a race of flesh eaters. They are described as evil ghouls that were created by the vices of humankind. Although its attitude is generally not human-friendly, it's human-friendly adjacent. It will cure diseases if enticed to do so. Its favorite pastime is the consumption of human flesh, so good luck with getting him to do that. Also included with this species is the Mbayu death. It was considered the chief of all malevolent creatures. There were vampires of a demonic nature who torment their victims through demonic possessions. Okay. The Vitala of India, which is also called the Pinuyama, meaning pure race, as in the Veda. It looks like an old woman, which was deformed, with long slits for eyes, discolored skin, poison fingernails, and was known for cannibalism. It sucks the blood of sleeping, drunken, or mad women. I'm thinking they were just trying to control the women here. Okay. It would enter the home by passing a magic thread down the chimney of the home. The Vitala also had the ability to possess corpses. These corpses would have their hands and feet pointing backwards, you know, so that you knew it was them. The Shirel or Shiral is a vicious, vengeful, ghost-like vampire found in India. It is normally a woman who died while pregnant during the Diwali festival or while unclean at any time. Yeah, they're pretty specific with these. They are said to have vile appearances, possessing pendulant breasts, thick, ugly lips, black tongues, and unkempt hair. So, you know, me on a regular Saturday morning. I'm kidding. They preyed upon young men, keeping them captive and slowly draining their life forces until they became withered old men. She's said to hate life and keeps all of her greatest spite for her relatives. Wow, that really could be me. All right. The Masan, also from India, is said to be usually the ghost of a child that delights in tormenting and killing other children. The Masan was able to curse a child that walks in its shadow. It will also follow a woman home should she allow her gown to drag on the ground over his shadow. Hey, and the Masani is a female vampire of India, and she is said to be the spirit of the burial grounds. The Masani is black in appearance, and her haunts are conducted at night, starting as she emerges from a funeral pyre. Anyone passing the burial site will be attacked, so, you know, stay out of graveyards. All right, the last vampire of India that we're going to touch upon, at least for now, is the Gayal. It's classified as a vampiric spirit that is usually created due to the death of a man who has no one to properly perform the burial rites at his funeral. When he returns, the Gayal wreaks his revenge upon the sons of others and upon his own relatives. The threat of a relative returning from the grave is usually enough to ensure that proper burial rites are performed. All right, so as you can see, there are so many legends that Bram Stoker pulled together to create the most well-known and most beloved Dracula. And there isn't just one myth for it. And as I've said before, and I'll probably say again, in every myth, there's a little bit of truth. And that's going to keep you up tonight. And with that, well, we've come to the end of the episode. And we will thank you for joining us today. And I hope that you'll take some time to reach out to us and share your thoughts. Tell me what you think happens. Tell me what you liked. Tell me what you didn't like. Hey, you can reach the show at darkenigmapodcast@gmail.com. And hey, if you have suggestions for future shows, or you just want to tell us what you think, you got a story, you just want to say hi, just no dick pics, okay? Drop me a line. And on that note, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining us on Renegade Talk Radio, and don't forget to tune in next time. And hey, keep it spooky!
We don't sugarcoat shit. This is Renegade.